The view from Colorado's Mount Chrysolite steals what little breath the climb doesn't. A shawl of snow rests on the peaks to the east, marking the continental divide. You'd swear that's Montana you see to the north. Circles of ice cold, trout packed, pristine ponds stretch through the valley like a straight string of pearls. Each Thursday morning during the summer, from some 400 kids make this 14,000-foot climb. They've traveled from all over the nation to spend a week at Frontier Ranch, a young life camp. Some come to escape their parents or hang out with a boyfriend, but before the week culminates, all hear about Jesus. All will witness his work from the top of Mount Chrysolite. They will all climb to the peak. For that reason, several young life counselors caboose the end of the pack. They prod and applaud, making sure every camper crests to the top. Max Locato relates, "I walked with them. One young student who shows great actuarial potential counted the strides to the peak, 8,000. But somewhere around number 4,000, Matthew from Minnesota decided to call it quits. He said he was far too tired to take another step. I took a quick liking to the guy. Most anyone would. Very jovial, pleasant. And in this case, Donkey determined not to climb to the top. He let everyone but a few of us pass him. "I'm heading down," he said. A young life staffer spelled out the consequences. "Can't send you down alone, friend. You turn back, we have to turn back." The small circle of we included me, says Max. "I didn't want to go back. I had two options, either miss the mountaintop or help Matt to see it. I coaxed him, I begged him, I negotiated a plan with him. 30 steps of walking, 60 seconds of resting. We inched along at that pace for about an hour, and finally we stood within 1,000 feet of that peak. But the last stretch of trail rose up as straight as a fireman's ladder. We got serious. Two guys each took an arm, and I took the rear. I placed both my hands on Matt's gluteus maximus and shoved. We all but dragged him above the timberline. And that's when we heard the applause. 400 kids on the crest of Mount Chrysolite gave Matt from Minnesota a standing ovation. They whooped and hollered and slapped him on the back. And as I slumped down to rest, this thought steamrolled my way. There it is, Max, a picture of my plan. Do all you can to push each other to the top. Well, from God? Well, sounds like something he might say. After all, his son did that. Jesus' self-assigned purpose reads, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." God's cure for the common life includes a heavy dose of servanthood. Timely reminder, as you celebrate your individual unique design, be careful. Don't so focus on what you love to do that you neglect what needs to be done. A 3 a.m. diaper change fits into very few sweet spots. Most stories don't feature the strength of garage sweeping. Visiting your sick neighbor might not come naturally to you, but still the sick need to be encouraged. The garage still needs sweeping. The diapers still need changing. the world needs servants. God has given each of you a gift from his great variety of spiritual gifts. Use them well to serve one another. That's 1 Peter 4:10. And Warren Wiersbe, commenting on that verse, says that love for the saints is important. And this love should be fervent. The original word pictures an athlete who is straining to reach the goal. It speaks of eagerness, intensity. Christian love is something we have to work at, just the way an athlete works on his or her skills. It's not a matter of emotional feeling, although that is included, but of dedicated will. Christian love means that we treat others the way God treats us, obeying his commandments in his word. For the world does need servants, people like Jesus who did not come to be served, but to serve. He chose remote Nazareth over center stage Jerusalem, his dad's carpentry shop over a marble columned palace, and 3 decades of anonymity over a life of popularity. Jesus came to serve. He selected prayer over sleep, the wilderness over the Jordan, irascible apostles over obedient angels. Max Lucado said he'd have chosen the angels. I'd have gone with them, given the choice. I'd have built my apostle team out of cherubim and seraphim, or Gabriel and Michael, eyewitnesses of Red Sea rescues, or Mount Carmel falling fires. I'd have chosen the angels. Not Jesus. He picked the people, Peter and Andrew, John and Matthew. When they feared the storm, he stilled it. When they had no coin for taxes, he supplied it. When they had no wine for the wedding or food for the multitude, he made both. He came to serve. He let a woman in Samaria interrupt his rest. A woman in adultery interrupt his sermon. A woman with a disease interrupt his plans, and one with remorse interrupt his meal. And though none of the apostles washed his feet, he washed theirs. Though none of the soldiers at the cross begged for mercy, he extended it. And though his followers skedaddle like scared rabbits on Thursday, he came searching for them on Easter Sunday. The resurrected king ascended to heaven only after he had spent 40 more days with his friends, teaching them, encouraging them, serving them. Why? Well, it's what he came to do. He came to serve. Joseph Shulam, who is a Jerusalem pastor, tells this remarkable true story of a man who simulated the actions of Jesus. The son of the rabbi battled severe emotional problems. And one day the boy went into the backyard, removed all his clothing. He assumed a crouched posture and began to gobble like a turkey. He did this not just for a few hours or a few days, but for weeks. And no pleading would dissuade him. No psychotherapist could help him. And a friend of the rabbi, having watched the boy and shared the father's grief, offered to help. And he, too, went out into the backyard, removed his clothing, crouched down, and began gobbling turkey-like. For a few days, nothing changed. And finally, the friend spoke to the son. "Do you think it'd be all right for turkeys to wear shirts?" And after some thought and some many gobbles, the son agreed. So they put on their shirts. A few days later, the friend asked the boy if it would be acceptable for turkeys to wear trousers. And the boy nodded. And in time, the friend redressed the boy. And in time, the boy returned to normal. You find that story incredible? I do. But not nearly as incredible as the actions of Jesus. He stripped himself of heaven's robe. He layered himself with human skin and hair. He hunched down in our world and spoke our language in the hope that he could lead this bunch of turkeys to home again. He, quote, set aside the privileges of deity. He took on the status of a slave. He became human. Having become human, he stayed human. It was an incredibly humbling process. He didn't claim special privileges. Instead, he lived a selfless, obedient life and then died a selfless, obedient death. And the worst kind of death at that, a crucifixion. That's Philippians 2, 7 and 8 out of the Message. Let's follow his example. Let's, quote, put on the apron of humility to serve one another. 1 Peter 5, 5. Jesus entered the world to serve. So we can enter our jobs, our homes, our churches. Servanthood requires no unique skill, no seminary degree. Regardless of your strengths, training, or church tenure, you can love the overlooked. Jesus sits in your classroom wearing the thick glasses, the outdated clothing, the sad face. You've seen him. He is Jesus. Jesus works in your office. Pregnant again, she shows up at work late, tired. No one knows the father, and according to the water cooler conversations, she doesn't even know the father. You've seen her. She's Jesus. When you talk to the lonely student, befriend the weary mom, you love Jesus. He dresses in the garb of the overlooked and ignored. Quote, whenever you did one of these things to someone overlooked or ignored, that was me. You did it for me. Matthew 25, 40. You can do that. Even if your sweet spot has nothing to do with encouraging others, the cure for the common life involves loving the overlooked. And you can also wave a white flag. We fight so much. Quote, where do you think all these appalling wars and quarrels come from? That is a brother of Jesus asking. Quote, do you think they just happen? Think again. They come about because you want your own way and fight for it deep inside yourselves. That's James 4, verse 1. Commenting on this verse, the Encouraging Word Bible says God planned for his people to be distinct by their peaceful and humble attitudes. Both words and actions mark these qualities. People who are self-sufficient must recognize that their plans and their lives are not their own, but could change in a moment. There are certain mountains only God can climb. The names of these mountains? Well, you'll see them if you look from the chapel window in the great house of God. Yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Matthew 6:13. A trio of peaks mantled by the clouds. Admire them, applaud them, but don't try to climb them. Or it's not that you aren't welcome to try. It's just that you aren't able. The pronoun is thine, not mine. Thine is the kingdom, not mine is the kingdom. If the word Savior is in your job description, it's because you put it there. Your role is to help the world, not save it. Mount Messiah is one of the mountains you weren't made to climb. And nor is Mount self-sufficient. You weren't able to run the world, nor are you able to sustain it. Some of you may think you can. You're self-made and you don't bow your knees. You just roll up your sleeves and put it in another 12-hour workday, which may be enough when it comes to making a living or building a business. But when you face your own grave or face your own guilt, your power will not do the trick. You weren't made to run a kingdom either, and nor are you expected to be all-powerful. And you certainly can't handle all the glory. Mount Applause is one of the most seductive of the three peaks. The higher you climb, the more people applaud, but the thinner the air becomes. More than one person has stood at the top and announced, "Mine is the glory," only to lose their balance and fall. Yours, Lord, is the kingdom, the power, the glory. And what protection this final phrase affords us. As you confess God is in charge, you admit that you aren't. As you proclaim that God has power, you admit that you don't. And as you give God the applause, there is none left to dizzy your brain. May God help us realize that we can't make life work on our own. Servants also resist stubbornness. Ulrich Zwingli manifested such a spirit. He promoted unity during Europe's Great Reformation, and at one point he found himself at odds with Martin Luther. And Zwingli did not know what to do, but he found his answer one morning on the side of a Swiss mountain. He watched two goats, the one climbing, the other descending, and at one point the narrow trail prevented them from passing each other. And when they saw each other, they backed up and lowered their heads as if ready to lunge. But then a wonderful thing happened. The ascending goat lay down in the path, and the other stepped over his back. The first animal then arose and continued his climb to the top, and Zwingli observed, "The goat made it higher because he was willing to bend lower." And didn't the same happen to Jesus? Philippians 2, 9 and 10. So God raised him to the highest place. God made his throne greater than every other name, so that every knee will bow to the name of Jesus. You can serve someone by swallowing your pride. Regardless of your design, you can wave a white flag and, "Oh, here is where the phone rang." At this point, and Max is writing these words together, his wife, Denalyn, called. "Busy?" she asked. "Well, sort of. Why?" "I need help unloading a cooler." "Oh," my voice trailed. "It's heavy. Can you come home and lift it out of the car?" "A cooler? I wanted to write. I wanted to finish this point, craft a humanity-changing book, record words to bless future generations. Does this woman not know my calling? Does she not know to whom she is married?" Angels were taking notes over my shoulder. And she wanted me to come home and lift a cooler? I did not want to help her. And then I remembered the theme of the chapter I was writing, servanthood. Ouch. Paul spoke to me when he wrote in Galatians 6:3, if you think you're too important to help someone in need, you're only fooling yourself. You are really a nobody. Denallan's response revealed another aspect of servanthood. Every day, do something you don't want to do. Pick up someone else's trash. Doesn't have to be a big thing. Helen Keller once told the Tennessee legislature that when she was young, she wanted to do great things and could not. And so she decided to do small things in a great way. Don't be too big to do something small. 1 Corinthians 15:58, throw yourself into the task of the master, confident that nothing you do for him is a waste of time or effort. Marin de Rothschild once asked artist Ari Scheffer to paint his portrait. Though he was a wealthy financier, Rothschild posed as a beggar, wearing rags, holding a tin cup. And during one day of painting, a friend of Ari's came into the room and, thinking Rothschild really was a beggar, dropped a coin in his cup. 10 years later, that man received a letter from Rome, Baron de Rothschild, and a check for 10,000 francs. The message read, "One day you gave a coin to Baron de Rothschild in the studio of Ari Scheffer. He invested it, and today sends you the capital which you entrusted to him, together with compound interest. A good action always brings good fortune." Well, we would add to that list. A good action not only brings good fortune, it brings God's attention. He notices the actions of servants. He sent his son to be one. And when you and I crest Mount Zion and hear the applause of saints, we'll realize this. Hands pushed us up the mountain too. The pierced hands of Jesus Christ, the greatest servant who ever lived. Selah.